Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, I'll chat with a physician and mom from Bexley who's working to keep young people safe from opioids. Also, it's Diabetes Awareness Month. Jay Fox will speak with a doctor about the impact of the disease in our community. He'll also speak with Ohio's Democratic U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown about new steps that are being taken to make federal jobs permanently accessible to applicants without college degrees. First up, on Columbus Perspective, fentanyl is the leading cause of preventable deaths for all Americans between the ages of 18 to 45. There's a new organization in the Columbus community, relatively new at this point. It's called Birdie Light, and we're joined by their leader, Dr. Beth Weinstock. She's going to tell us her story today about what inspired her to start this organization and the important work that they're doing in the community. Hi, Dr. Weinstock. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Kate, for having me.
First off, if you would, please share with us what it was that inspired you to start Birdie Light.
Absolutely. I'm a practicing physician here in Columbus for the last 25 years or so. And I even work with patients who struggle with substance use disorder. But nothing prepared me for March 3rd of 2021 when my son, Eli, who was a sophomore at American University at the time, died from an accidental fentanyl ingestion. He wasn't intending to die, nor are the thousands of people who die every year from accidental fentanyl ingestion. So we, of course, had about a six-month period before my family could even get back up on our feet. And we were inspired to start Birdie Light because what we found at the time with a lot of research is there was really no organization that was getting directly in front of young people and telling them what they're up against when it comes to the drug landscape in our country and also fentanyl in particular. And we also, of course, motivated emotionally in the sense that if only Eli had had this information in the forefront of his brain and knowledge before he took a pill that essentially I assume he considered to be safe, and he did not consider what he was taking to have fentanyl in it and also that it could be lethal. So we launched Birdie Light, which is essentially an organization, a national organization that gets in front of young people and age 12 to 25 and teaches them, you know, the facts. Here's what fentanyl is. Here's how you stay safe from it. Here is how you tell your peers about it. And that's what we've been doing for the last 3.5 years.
You've survived what can only be described as every parent's worst nightmare, and you are now turning that into something to help others. I find it so noteworthy that you said you start with young people at the age of 12. That has got to be a stark reality for those parents and for you as a parent to see people that young that are in danger of fentanyl exposure. What was it that made you say, yeah, we've got to start them that young?
Well, it's interesting you asked that. Originally, we had stated our mission was to reach young teens and adults age 14 to 25, but we're flexible and we've been able to shape our mission around what's needed. And what we heard from so many educators and professionals essentially said they need to hear this earlier based on what they were seeing in their communities or their schools. And so we have expanded our possible audience to down to age 12. Again, you know, if we went to a middle school and there was a sixth grade class that wanted us to speak to them, maybe not everyone's 12, but, you know, in the general sense, we've lowered the age just because this crisis is taking so many young lives below 14 even. So we're flexible and we're able to speak to young people and also the touch points around them. So we educate professionals such as physicians, nurses, social workers, et cetera. And then we speak to many parent groups because we feel like as many touch points of We call them community of caring around a young person. How do we educate all of them as well to reinforce our message? And that's been very successful.
Dr. Beth Weinstock is a co-founder of an organization called Birdie Light. They're actually working on a national level after a family tragedy, losing Dr. Beth's son to a fentanyl exposure, and realizing that so many young people in America right now are being accidentally or unknowingly exposed to this lethal drug. Dr. Weinstock, if you would, share a little more about what it is exactly that Birdie Light is doing, not only talking to young people, but you're also providing them with some tools to help keep safe, aren't you?
Yes, and we have essentially three arms of what we do. One is visiting high schools, college campuses, middle schools, and other groups in person to spread awareness, to show slides and different pictures of counterfeit pills, to help explain exactly what fentanyl is. So many people don't know, even though they see it in the news a lot. And so there's a visual component to what we do. We also distribute life-saving tools such as fentanyl test strips and Narcan where needed. And we have a distribution program on our website regarding fentanyl test strips, because we feel that knowledge is probably the most important thing, but the ability to take your own safety into your own hands in the moment of ingestion of a substance is probably one of the more powerful ways to empower young people. And that young person may never take a pill or a powder, but at least they're able to be the hero in the situation and keep their friends safe or their peers or family. And then the third arm of what we do is that we have created a curriculum that is essentially duplicates what we're already doing, but it's in curriculum form so that a health educator or a public health official, a social worker, et cetera, can deliver the same curriculum that we're already trying to deliver. And that just increases the scope of the number of people we're able to reach.
Dr. Weinstock, after losing your son 3 years ago to unintentional fentanyl poisoning, what do you say to other parents now when they maybe express doubt and say the classic, "Oh, my kid would never do that"?
I have heard that phrase, and even maybe not verbally, but you know, there's a feeling that, of course, I had the luxury of having almost 4 years ago, where I could have a sense in my mind that not my kid, no, this would never happen. And I would want to point out that if you really look at the data and the numbers of people who are dying, that it's going to be hard to say in 10 years or historically that you weren't touched by the fentanyl epidemic in some way. The data really shows that this is really an American problem. This isn't an out there problem, or not in my family, not in my community. It really is a problem that we all need to look at as a public health crisis. And I really hope and pray that everyone who thinks not my kid is actually ends up, you know, being correct about that. But I do think that we all have a duty as citizens, as caretakers of young people, to take part in the solution to this epidemic, even if your kid never does, which is what I hope and pray for you. But I think we all have a duty to help when it comes to an issue that's affecting so many young lives.
And for those who are listening who want to help, and maybe it's not your child, but it's your child's friend, or you see the possibility in your child's friend group and you think, "I want to be armed with the test strips and the naloxone just in case," even if it's a stranger, what can someone do? Can they ask for your help from Birdie Light? Where are the resources that people can use in the Columbus community specifically to help them fight the fentanyl epidemic?
I'm so happy you asked that question. The The main thing that Birdie Light can do is first of all, answer a lot of questions. So you can contact us through our website. The second thing is that if you see a need in your community or your young person's high school or middle school, or even as they head off to a secondary education, is to reach out to us so that we can help arrange an event that would reach those young people you're concerned about. And that's what we do on a daily basis is we create programming for different areas of Columbus and Ohio and nationally. So we can always help expedite that because we have the connections and the experience in the Columbus area. The second thing is that Narcan is readily available. If you did want to obtain some of that over the counter, you can get it at nearly all pharmacies. And even if it's still behind the counter, the pharmacist can give it to you without a prescription. It's going to cost money there, $35 to $45, but you can also get it for free. Franklin County Public Health, the website Harm Reduction Ohio will ship Narcan to you for free anywhere in the state. So there are so many resources out there to get Narcan, which is an opioid reversal agent. The fentanyl test strips are also becoming much easier to find, also by the public health department, as well as our website. So we can help with all that. But if it's more of an outreach just to get an event on the books or an educational program, we can help with that too.
That website address is birdielight.org, and that's spelled BIRDIELIGHT. And Dr. Weinstock, I understand there's a very interesting story about you naming your organization and discovering after it was named how it's kind of paying special tribute to your son.
My favorite story. That is true. We were trying to think of names for our organization early on, and we wanted it to be unique, like Eli. And we knew in middle school, Eli and his buddies, a group of young boys, called themselves the Birdies. And I never really understood why that came about, but it stuck. And then at his memorial service in our backyard, people had set up tables and cards for guests to write on. And we found after the fact that a lot of, we assumed those friends had written, "We love you, Birdie. We miss you, Birdie." And so I pulled that into the name, and then we started sketching and working around what a bird logo would look like. And I came up with the canary in the coal mine. On our logo, you can see the canary has a coal miner's hat with a light on it. And I thought that equated with, that phrase of how a bird would go down to check for safety before the humans went down into the mine. And I thought, well, that's similar to what we're doing with both the education as well as the fentanyl test strips. And so we played around with that image, and then we played around with names. And there were many names I wrote on a list, but after the fact, I wrote down Birdie Light, and we liked it. And then it was after that we had looked at the name and liked it that I said, "Oh no, wow, Eli, ELI is right in the middle of the word Birdie Light." And we didn't plan that. And of course, it stuck then as our name forever. And, Eli is in the center of everything we do. Every morning when we wake up and think we're going to fight in his name, we know that Eli's in the middle of every effort we make. And it'll stay that way.
Dr. Beth Weinstock, the co-founder of Birdie Light, they're working hard in memory of Eli to make sure that no one else dies of fentanyl poisoning. Thank you, Dr. Weinstock, for joining us today on Columbus Perspective.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
It is estimated that over 1.1 million people in Ohio have been diagnosed with diabetes. That's almost 13% of our state population. Even worse, more than 250,000 Ohioans have diabetes but are unaware of it. In 2020, diabetes was the primary cause of death for almost 4,400 Ohioans. The counties east and south of Columbus have been impacted the most. November is National Diabetes Awareness Month. Dr. Griffin Rogers is the director of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, and joins us on Columbus Perspective today. Welcome, Dr. Rogers.
Well, thanks for having me today.
How does diabetes affect the body? What kind of health problems can it cause?
Well, the diabetes, of course, is associated with high blood sugar or high blood glucose. And this high blood glucose from diabetes can damage blood vessels and nerves in many parts of the body. Diabetes, together with high blood pressure and high cholesterol, which frequently run together, are associated with increased risk of heart attacks, strokes, diseases of the kidneys, the eyes, the teeth, and the feet, and those all relate to the effects that the high blood sugars have on the blood vessels. So, therefore, managing diabetes as soon as possible after the diagnosis may help individuals stay healthier longer and prevent some of these complications that we just talked about.
So, what would put somebody at high risk for developing diabetes?
Well, there are several factors, some that are controllable, others that are not. Having overweight or obesity increases the risk of type 2 diabetes. And you mentioned the numbers in Ohio with a prevalence of about 13.2% of diabetes. Obesity prevalence in Ohio is around 36%. It's actually among the top 20 states in the United States with the highest prevalence. If you're older than 35 or older, you're at increased risk. If you have a family history of diabetes, particularly in first-degree relatives, that puts you at higher risk. Being generally physically inactive increases your risk. And then certain racial and ethnic groups like African Americans, Asian and Hispanic Americans, American Indians, Pacific Islanders are also at increased risk. And then finally, women who develop diabetes during pregnancy, a condition known as gestational diabetes, are at increased risk of developing diabetes within the next 5 to 10 years.
Now, some of the treatments for diabetes are also being used for weight loss right now. Does managing diabetes or preventing diabetes go hand in hand with weight loss?
Well, the results of our diabetes prevention program called DPP showed that people were at high risk of developing diabetes, such as those that had prediabetes or those that had a history of gestational diabetes. By losing just 5 to 7% of your body weight through diet and exercise, decreased your risk of developing diabetes by 58%. And in fact, if you look at people who are 60 and older at the beginning of this study when they were randomized, they were able to increase or decrease their risk of developing diabetes by some 70%. So the good news there is it's never too late to start. And so, yes, there is a relationship between weight and your risk. And by losing small amounts of weight, one can reduce one's risk of developing diabetes.
So we've heard this before, the ABCs or the 1-2-3s of diabetes. What are the fine points that people should remember?
Sure. The ABCs are a useful mnemonic to kind of remember what are values that are important and one should discuss with your healthcare provider during your regular visits to see whether you're within pre-specified goals. The A stands for the A1C test. This test measures your average blood sugar or blood glucose in the previous 3 months. The B stands for blood pressure, and the C stands for cholesterol. As I mentioned before, glucose, blood pressure, and high cholesterol all contribute to that nerve and blood vessel damage. And then the S in that stands for stop smoking. Not smoking is especially important for people with diabetes because both smoking and diabetes cause damage and narrow the blood vessels, leading to heart attacks and strokes and eye disease and kidney disease and the like.
What do you think causes somebody to not know that they have diabetes when they actually have it? Wouldn't it be fairly obvious that something is wrong?
Well, not certainly if you're in that risk groups that we talked about, and that's why I always enjoy coming on and sharing this information with the public. You may the symptoms associated with high blood glucose are generally feeling tired, frequent urination, feeling thirsty, not having your energy level, maybe perhaps blurred vision, but those are not constant. And of course, one can always attribute that to something else. I didn't get enough sleep last night, or maybe I have a cold or something like that. It turns out that a lot of people only learn that they have diabetes when they present to their healthcare provider or to a hospital with one or more of those complications. So that's why if you're at high risk, and we talked about what puts you at higher risk, you should see your healthcare provider on a regular basis, and if not tested for blood for diabetes, to ask your healthcare provider to test you.
So if I am a patient potentially at home, and I want to educate myself a little bit more before I go see the doctor, does the NIH have a section on their website geared toward diabetes that I could look at?
Oh, absolutely. Our website, you can visit our website, NIDDK.NIH.gov, to learn more about diabetes and get more information. We have a variety of free resources that are available, many in several different languages. And so, yeah, you can learn about some of the things that we talked about here and even more in terms of management, drugs that are effective, and just regular sort of meal plan, physical activity, getting enough sleep, taking your medications, even if you're feeling healthy, to forestall these complications.
November is National Diabetes Awareness Month. We want to thank Dr. Griffin Rogers for being our guest today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Jobs and the economy continue to be top of mind for Columbus and really all Ohio citizens. Over 40,000 people in Columbus are still unemployed. Senior U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown joins us to address those concerns. Senator, how can we make federal jobs more accessible to all workers, especially those that don't have college degrees?
Jay, thank you. It's pretty simple. Everybody should be able to find a good paying, rewarding job. You know, whether you go to Columbus State, whether you go straight from high school into a building trades program, either building futures or directly into an electrician's or a roofer's or a painter's apprentice program, or whether you came from the military, whether you just want any kind of job. And 70% of Ohioans do not have a bachelor's degree. For most of them, there is no path in the federal government, in the federal workforce. So President Trump had issued an executive order. President Biden kept it in place to say to the government, you can't block people who don't have a college degree. These jobs should be open. Last two presidents, one of each party, have done the right thing. We want to write it into federal law because executive orders don't quite have the standing that federal law does.
So this would be the Federal Jobs for Stars Act?
Yeah, it would. Great opportunity for skilled, experienced Ohioans, you know, who went to a trade school or community college or have on the job experience. Plenty of people are qualified for plenty of these jobs that, you know, that didn't go to Otterbein or Ohio State or didn't graduate from Columbus State. So we want to make sure that those pathways are open. Too many people in our society have preached, too many people in positions like mine have preached to people, you got to go to college, you got to go to college. Well, I did. Plenty of people do. It's a good path for many, but, you know, 2/3 of Ohioans don't get a 4-year degree. So they should have every bit as chance. I mean, when you talk about the dignity of work, as I do, you know, whether you're wherever you're working, you work hard, you ought to be able to get ahead, period.
So part of creating those opportunities is investing in manufacturing and jobs development. What are some examples of how Ohio is making those investments today beyond Intel?
Yeah, we have Ohio, I think that Ohio is the number one manufacturing state in the country. I resent it and argue against it when some of my fellow elected officials talk about the Rust Belt, because we're not. We have our manufacturing camps that we started there. We've had 200 of them in around the state, aimed at young people, aimed at kids, aimed at 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, to expose them to manufacturing their communities. They're 1-week summer camps run usually by local businesses. It was our idea, but we're working to get more and more. As I said, we've had 200 of them. There's something called Building Futures to get young people ready to go into the building trades. And if you have an apprentice card for the electricians or roofers or painters or laborers or operating engineers, you start off at $18, $19 an hour with all benefits, retirement and health care. Within 5 years, you get a journeyman's card, and you're probably making $30 to $35, maybe a little more, and you have no college debt. So there are a lot of opportunities. We need it with Intel. We need it with the infrastructure bill. Lots of trades jobs that take great skill, working with your brain and your hands, and proud work that builds our future.
Part of luring companies to come to Ohio and specific cities often involves tax abatements and other incentives to the companies. What safeguards protect our investments when companies say they'll create jobs and then either they simply don't or maybe even abandon their locations?
Well, there should be a payback from those companies to taxpayers, and these have to be written the right way. I think, though, I hear your question, but I think the way to attract jobs in this state is to have a skilled workforce that's reliable. I know sometimes government needs to invest and partner with companies coming in and give them incentives and all that. That can work, but I want to be a state where manufacturing is welcome. I want to be a state that we have things like the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. But I think ultimately it's a workforce, and Ohio's a great place to live. The cost of living is less than coastal states, less than suburban Chicago. I grew up in Mansfield, a town that was a town of 50,000, lost a lot of manufacturing jobs, great place to live, great place to grow up, good public schools. They've been hurting, and they'd love to they'd love to see more companies move in, and I think we can say we're the best workers in the world. We make the cleanest steel in Ohio and Cleveland Cliffs, which is dotted all over the state. We have the biggest solar energy manufacturer in all of North America near Toledo. We're bringing Intel in. I mean, a lot of this didn't happen with public dollars. It happened because we're a good place to live and a good place to work, and we have productive workers.
And you mentioned Mansfield, and that former Westinghouse campus has got a lot of attention lately. They tore down one of the buildings, but that campus sits in the middle of downtown on an active railway.
Yeah, and there's we have a lot of that. Westinghouse at one point, when I was a really little kid, had 8,000 workers, and we're not going to see those kinds of plants anymore. But Mansfield, they were skilled workers. If I remember, they made electric ranges, but I can't swear at that because I was pretty little. But I mean, there's a lot of those sort of iconic companies. Again, we're not going to go back to that. But one of the things we finally have an industrial policy in this country now, finally in the last 3 or 4 years, and we've got to make sure for that industrial policy to work that we are enforcing trade rules so foreign countries that essentially can't cheat and cost us jobs. We just recently were able on a new transformer rule. We talked to EPA. We worked with the Department of Energy to make sure that our laws were such that we could begin to locate, as we need to produce more electricity, we need more transformers. The technology is very advanced, and we're building those in, well, not Ohio exactly, but about half the workers will be from Ohio, and we're in West Virginia. So it's 600 jobs that are coming soon in a steel plant that was shuttered or at least idled, and these jobs are coming back, and about 300 of them will be in Ohio, most of the other 300 in West Virginia, a few in Pennsylvania.
All good news. We want to thank Senator Sherrod Brown for taking time from his busy day to talk to us today.
Thank you, Jay.
And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. Please note that the following Face the State segment aired prior to Election Day.
Joining me now to talk about key election issues is Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Sir, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Doug.
Any surprises on how big the numbers have been for early voting?
No, not really. In fact, it's about what we would expect. And in some counties, they've broken records. Others are just below the all-time record. But we knew that there was going to be a lot of turnout.
Have you heard any of any major voting issues or concerns that have come up, whether it's with early voting or prepping for the big day on Tuesday?
Not major issues, but we work through things. A vendor error where some vendor was behind on getting ballots printed, or a mistake that had been made by a poll worker that gets rectified. But really, all in all, things are going quite smoothly. Again, it's because of the prep work we do ahead of time. You've heard my saying, we sweat in training so we don't bleed in battle. That's an old Army saying. We do the work ahead of time to make sure that we're ready, that our boards of elections have the logistics and the training and the personnel in place. Mm-hmm. And it's showing. Ohio knows how to run elections. We do it very well. We really are the gold standard for the nation.
As I mentioned, early voting, no early voting tomorrow. Now, I understand there used to be on Monday, but there isn't anymore. Why not?
Just a couple years ago, and it was the bipartisan elections officials that had said, guys, we need that day to prepare for Tuesday. So Ohio has kept the same number of early voting hours. We've actually, it's a win-win for the voters and for the elections officials. We've created more evening and weekend hours. That's a good thing. We're one of only 5 states in the country that has Sunday early voting. Procrastination is a real thing. Some folks wait to the last minute.
I know that we talked with the League of Women Voters a couple days ago about the common questions from voters. And the big one, the top of their list, was the voter ID requirements, because Ohio did change the voter ID requirements a few years ago, I think in 2021.
For most of us, we're accustomed to this. 98% of voters going back decades have brought their state ID or their driver's license. There was always a small number that would use the alternative forms. Those alternative forms, such as a pay stub or a utility bill, you can't
use
that
anymore.
Yeah. It's got to be a government-issued photo ID. For most of us, again, that's a state ID or a driver's license. It can't be expired. It's got to be a current state ID or driver's license. For folks like me, it could be a military ID, a passport. There's a full list on our website, and I know that you're going to share it with the viewers as well.
You know, we've received questions. I know elections officials have received questions. Your office has certainly received questions about what is allowed and not allowed to be worn inside a polling location. Your office actually just put out some revised guidance on this. We have another graphic explaining the 3 main points. Really, this boils down to someone can't go into a polling location with the name of a political party, candidate, or support or opposition to an issue, right?
Yeah, and let's just use some common sense about this, folks. The law says you can't campaign inside a polling location. Let's not make this a distraction. We have a responsibility to uphold the law, and it's been the law in Ohio for decades. We also have a responsibility to maintain an orderly and a civil environment inside those polling locations. So if somebody comes in wearing their vote for candidate X shirt, they're going to ask, the poll workers are going to ask that individual, would you turn it inside out, or would you put a jacket on over it, because they're required to do that by law. But listen, nobody's turned away. Nobody is going to be denied the ability to vote. If they insist on wearing that shirt, then they're just going to vote and get on their way. What we're also not going to do is engage in anybody's social media circus. People come in filming something and trying to look for a conflict. We're not interested in that. You're going to cast your vote and you're going to be on your way. But common sense is you're not allowed to campaign inside a polling location. So
yeah, and I also understand the guidance kind of talked about slogans as well, where a slogan, as long as it doesn't have the name of the party, the name
That's
of
correct.
The candidate, or the support or opposition to an issue, is okay as well.
Again, this can become a big distraction, and so we're not looking to let that happen. There are people that have overinterpreted this in the past and said, for example, if you're wearing your high school team mascot, that's expressing support for the team or for the school
levy or something.
The school levy or what have you. So again, this could get ridiculous if now there's a thing where the Trump campaign has been wearing a reflective vest because of the comment by President Biden. So are we going to tell people they can't do that? Absolutely not. Listen, if it says a candidate's name, if it says vote for or support this candidate, then we're going to ask you not to wear it. But other things, we're not going to be the clothing police.
What else, or what is in place now to make sure that this election is secure, accurate, and fair?
Ohio leads the nation in this. It starts with the people. It always does. It's the 35,000 Republican and Democratic poll workers that are trained, dedicated. They take an oath to do this work, and they take this work very seriously. And that's why I say treat them with respect when you come to their polling location, your polling location on Election Day. It goes on to things like voter list maintenance. We take deceased voters off the rolls. We make sure only American citizens are on the rolls. We check IDs. We have a bipartisan oversight of every part of the process, and we audit the results. Every vote in Ohio is on paper. Whether you fill in an oval or touch a screen, every vote in Ohio is on paper, and that gives us the chance to audit that election. We've had an accuracy rate above 99%, 99.98 was the accuracy rate the last time we had a presidential election. Ohioans can be proud of the way we run elections, and we'll give you those results on election night.
You mentioned the checking for citizenship. Mm-hmm. The poll workers have been trained to do that this
Correct.
Year. I believe the ACLU pushed back on that and challenged that in court, saying that it could disenfranchise or be discriminatory against naturalized citizens. Mm-hmm. Where does that stand, and what's your response to
Well, thankfully, they lost that ridiculous lawsuit. I think most people recognize that that's not common sense. When someone shows up with an ID card that says non-citizen on it, we're going to make them present additional proof that they're maybe have taken the oath, they've become a naturalized citizen. That's just common sense. Of course, we work to make sure that non-citizens never end up on the voter rolls. But if your ID card says non-citizen, we're going to ask you for some additional information, and you're going to have to show proof of citizenship before
they bring their naturalization papers
Absolutely.
With them.
Absolutely. And by the way, months ago, we sent letters to recently naturalized saying you should update your driver's license so that you have the U.S. citizen driver's license or state ID and not the non-citizen version of it.
So we talked also, just real quick, the voting machines themselves are, people hear about maybe this could be hacked. They're never connected to the internet.
Never right? connected, strictly air-gapped, no Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, LAN connection, modem, nothing that connects it to the outside world. That's why, though, we're able to give you that rapid result on election night, is we use electronic tabulation to give you that result, but then we go back and count the paper. So we don't just have electronic or just paper. We have both in parallel, and the two have to reconcile.
We talked about that type of voter voting security, but what about the actual physical security? Yeah. People can get emotional on election days. What's in place at polling locations to make sure people feel safe?
Yeah, so this is, again, something that we've been working on for really well over a year, working with local, state, and federal law enforcement officials to make sure that not only are we ready to respond, but we're ready to prevent things from happening by monitoring trends on social media. Some people may make a threat or whatever else. We take all those kind of things seriously. I'm happy to say that there haven't been anything that has materialized here in Ohio, but we do keep an eye on this. Of course, we work closely with county sheriffs, city police, and state law enforcement as well, and we monitor these situations.
if someone is in line by 7:30 and maybe that line's an hour long, will they get to vote?
Absolutely. Nobody's turned away from a polling location. As long as you're there by 7:30, you will get to vote. What they're instructed to do is to put a poll worker at the end of the line at 7:30 so people can't join at 7:35, 7:36, okay. That kind of thing. But don't delay. Get out there and vote. Don't wait till the last minute.
So do you have what's in place when issues come up on election night for your office? How do you deal with, you know, call them crises, if you will, but, you know, incidents that happen that you need to deal with quickly?
And there are hundreds of little things that come up, from a power outage to, you know, a fire alarm going off at a building, whatever else. We've built, probably from my military background, what would we call our command center, where we, in a linear fashion, we receive information from phone calls, social media, from the conventional media. It comes from all different sources. We triage that information. We act on it with the subject matter experts we have around the table. We can communicate that. On any given election, like I said, 200 to 300 different tickets come through that we can work through and make sure those problems are solved, because it's a no-fail mission. From 6:30 a.m. until 7:30 p.m., we have that opportunity to make sure every Ohioan gets their voice heard, and we're not going to be deterred from that. And so we react to these kind of things, and we're proactive about identifying evolving problems, whether they're systemic or whether it's a one-off, and making sure that we get those problems solved.
And shortly after 7:30, we'll start getting those initial results of the absentee and the early votes.
Yeah, and it's important to point that out. Early votes and absentee votes are the very first ballots counted. By 9 or so, we're going to be counting the Election Day votes. We're going to stay up late, brew a pot of coffee, and let Ohioans know those Election Day results on Election Night.
A lot of tight races out there, so it may be a little while for people to get those results they want so badly. All right. Secretary LaRose, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate
thank you, Doug.
It today. What I want to tell you about now is, if you want more information, all you have to do is text the word VOTE to 614-460-3345. We'll send you a link to our voter guide that includes a breakdown of the major races and issues on the ballot. Also, a lot of great information at voteohio.gov. That is the Secretary of State's website.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.